And we are live. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My name is Angelo, and I am guest hosting tonight. And we're going to be talking about noticing things. When did you first start noticing that things might not be going as well as the establishment, the media, and the politicians tell us are going? And I'm going to be speaking with Greg Johnson. So let me bring him on. Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
And we also have David Zutty is here. Or is he joining us later?
Hey, good to see you.
Okay, he's here. Okay, yeah, good to talk with you as well. So, gentlemen, noticing things. How did we get here, basically? When did you first start to see with new eyes? Let's start with you, Greg. What are some of the experiences that led you to be the man you are now?
Well, contrary to the cliches that liberals like to deal in, my doubts about multiculturalism were based largely on experience, not ignorance. I grew up in a lily white town. I grew up in a little corner of Montana. There was precious little diversity there. There were a couple people of full or partial American Indian descent, a couple of people from exotic places. There was one guy who was a school teacher from Egypt, and another was Turkish of some sort. But that was about as exotic as it got. And these people were just a tiny, tiny minority. And it was overwhelmingly white. And I grew up in an overwhelmingly white, high trust sort of society. And I was a curious kid. I was very interested in history and anthropology and archaeology. I collected old issues of National Geographic magazine because it was just fascinated with the world. I was very fascinated with what we could call human biodiversity and human cultural diversity. And I just thought it was the most wonderful thing. I went off to college and I didn't get really exposed to much diversity as an undergraduate because of where I went. Again, very white areas. And it was really when I hit graduate school that I had a large dose of racial diversity, especially African-American style racial diversity. And I remember the first day I showed up at my graduate school, it'd been traveling a lot and I was just tired and everything. And I went to the school to sort of check in with the head office and get some orientation materials. This was before everything was online, right? You had to actually go to places and knock on doors, make appointments, things like that, get papers and follow instructions on paper. So anyway, I did that and I had a bunch of stuff with me and it was a hot day and I got a locker in one of the buildings at the university. And I put some of the extra stuff in the locker and I was going to rush off and do an appointment. And I walked down to the end of a hallway and through the glass doors towards the staircase, and I realized I had dropped my wallet while I was back at the locker. So I turned immediately around and walked back through the doors, walked back to the place where the wallet should have been, and it wasn't there. There were two black gentlemen just a few paces away, and I, maybe a little bit insistently, a little bit knowingly, but it was obviously the case that either they had picked it up or they would have seen who had picked it up. It was simply impossible for them not to know. So I said in a somewhat neutral tone, "Where's the wallet?" And they just commenced to shucking and jiving. And I just thought, oh God, you know, what am I going to do? So I go off to the office that I was supposed to be at. And I said, I think these two gentlemen over in such and such hall stole my wallet today. Just now. And I went through a whole process. And basically, what happened was this. And it became very, very apparent to me. These two guys, because they belong to a very tight racial group, and they were also basically partners in crime, were going to work as a team. And everybody I approached about this problem just had to to approach this as an individual, and not just as an individual, a fair-minded individual, but to bend over forwards and backwards and fawn over and treat with kid gloves these blacks, these black employees. They're just like janitorial staff, stuff like that. And it just hit me like lightning that these people have a systematic advantage, and none of the people that I'm going to talk to will do anything more than their job, basically. And that I would never get my wallet back. I'd never get my money back. Like a year later, the wallet was found, of course, emptied of everything valuable except for a couple pieces of ID, and thrown behind a soda machine in the basement of that building. But anyway, that just hit me. And I realized here I am, I'm surrounded by these people. These people work together. White people have to pretend like we're just individuals, and they're just individuals too. And we will go through our process of carefully weighing everything out. And it puts us at a systematic disadvantage. So that was a very valuable lesson I learned in graduate school before the first classes actually convened. And at that point, it was a good thing, though, because at that point, I probably would have been one of these overly trusting people, lowering my defense shields and reaching out the hand of friendship to these people everywhere I went, which would have just put me in actual danger, just to be fairly frank of it. I would have been in danger. And so in a way, it was a valuable lesson, because immediately from that point on, I had a shield of suspicion up, and I was very, very watchful. And there were no other incidents like that during my coursework years. And so, yeah, that was really the first thing. It was the first day of graduate school, and realizing there's an asymmetry, a systematic disadvantage that exists between white people who operate on an individualist system of rules and non-whites who work as collectives. And it's very, very easy for them, by working as a team, to defeat us, and that this can't end well. At the very least, it occurred to me that we can't have too many of these people around. Otherwise, our civilization will just be overwhelmed. And being around in a city back east with a very large black population, with a black mayor, with feather-bedded, black-run, you know, basically city offices and things like that, it was very, very clear that certain things just couldn't work that way. And that there was this necrosis, this creeping social death and gridlock that was caused by affirmative action and just basically black nepotism. And I just thought, we need a solution to this. This can't go on forever. And I just wanted to stay away from it as much as I could. I wanted to get away from it as quickly as I could. And so that was the first lesson. The second thing that happened was years later, after I'd finished my coursework, and I was preparing for my comprehensive exams, and I got a job doing part-time teaching introduction to philosophy at a historically black college. And again, this was highly educational for me, and it was educational for the students. They learned a lot. I was a very good teacher. I got good marks. I actually had good relations with a number of really bright students, but I was learning a whole lot too. And one of the things that really brought home to me the hopelessness of blacks and whites living together in the same society is something that people have been talking about very recently with the death of O.J. Simpson. Because in 1995, the day that the Simpson verdict was read, I was teaching on the campus of a black college. And this, of course, is a college that attracts what's somewhat optimistically called the talented 10th. And even these talented tenthers were chimping. They were giddy. They were absolutely delighted and out of control when the word came down that the juice was loose and that he got away with murder. And there was no pretense that this guy was innocent. They were joyous that he got away with murder. And I felt very lonely that day. And I felt that this simply can't work. We simply can't live together. We can't have two peoples this different under the same system of laws. And if you put them in positions where they can make decisions, like on juries, this is the kind of travesty that you can expect.
Did you feel a sense of betrayal when it came to the stolen wallet, the reaction from the thieves, the way they teamed up together and had this sort of dishonest solidarity? Did you feel in that moment, did you feel a sense of being betrayed, that you felt like they had let down their end of the quote unquote social contract?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was obvious that they either took it or they saw who took it. And their behavior immediately made me think that they took it. And there was absolutely nothing I could do. I couldn't physically assault them, although I was angry enough to. But there was just nothing I could do. And I left the building. I went on to this appointment. And every step I took, I realized with each passing second, the chances of me ever getting my money back were diminishing, right? And it was just an indignity. I didn't have a lot of money. And I had just made this big leap of faith into a new city, the next stage in my academic studies and so forth. And yeah, I know that if I had been, if the positions had been reversed, I certainly wouldn't behave that way. But I mostly felt let down by my fellow white people, and they were actually fellow white people. They were just, you know, they were just operating. They were operating by the rules, okay, and then a little bit more, because being surrounded by blacks and dealing with blacks, and you know this was a long time ago. People want to paint the 90s as a lovely time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, all the way back into the 60s and 70s, people walked on eggshells around blacks, mm-hmm. and had to accommodate themselves to their misbehavior. And every time that they would accommodate themselves to black misbehavior, it took the form of an injustice to fellow white people. That's just the way it is. That's what I saw. I saw this careful fawning, petting, walking on eggshells type of behavior towards these people. And you know, I just wanted my money back. But at a certain point, it just became a matter of principle. It's like, mm-hmm. I just want people to act honest. I just don't want to hear more bullshit and evasions.
Yeah. Let's bring David into the conversation. Yeah. David, what were some of the formative experiences for you that started to make the gears turn and led you down this path?
So I was born in the late 1980s, so my red pill journey was very long and winding and kind of was all over the place. But I'm going to start ironically with how it seemed like the newcomers, they had to assimilate less into American culture than I had to assimilate into their culture. And I'm from Southern California, so we have a lot of Mexicans and other Hispanics. And it's very ironic that the thing which is oftentimes the final argument for mass migration, as observed by Morgoth and many others, is a wide variety of ethnic cuisine. And this is actually what began to turn me off to immigration before almost anything else, is that I had Mexican food shoved down my throat nonstop. And high-end Mexican food can be good. But this whole like little taco stand stuff, or they have these little crappy restaurants that always end in Berto, like Eroberto, Alberto. Everyone in my community, especially in my high school, wanted to go to Mexican food all the time. And I just want to say, like, can we just do anything other than Mexican food? Like, I'll take anything else. And it really began to rub me the wrong way, because I like barbecue food. That's an American food. But here I am, supposedly in America, and my food does not exist. I can't get my delicious barbecue anywhere. I like barbecue sauce. It probably comes, you know, has something to do with my Hungarian ancestry, because paprika and chili, whatever. But I don't have barbecue sauce. Even hamburgers, they're being pushed out, it seems like. And so just on food alone, I felt like I was unironically being colonized. And it began to really rub me the wrong way because it's so constant and insistent. And then two, there's a language. My ancestors came from all sorts of different little corners of Europe, like random parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We tragically lost a lot of the language, actually all the language. But here, all these Mexicans come across the border and they are refused. It's one thing to just keep the language. I wouldn't mind it if they spoke Spanish. I'm for everyone keeping their heritage alive, their language. But they didn't learn English or much of it. They didn't seem to try. And here I was learning Spanish in high school out of interest. And it just rubbed me again the wrong way that I seemed more interested in learning Spanish than some of these people were in learning English. And that it was ridiculous. It's one of those double standards that conservatives always go on about. I mean, I don't have press. There's no press 3-4 Hungarian. That'd be ridiculous. And the other second issue that was a big kind of dawned on me in late high school was when I began to pick up on ethnic networking. And this was first in the context of scholarships, but I began to see it everywhere. I was not to brag, a model student, overachiever. I had over a 4.0 GPA. I ran a mile in under 5 minutes and zero discipline record, star student basically. And so I go to the scholarship office, try and get some financial help because I'm white, but I do not have a trust fund. It seems to be that the salaried class doesn't seem to think that white people, there are white people out there without trust funds who have to like pay and work. So I go into the scholarship office, and every single scholarship is diversity-based. Let me check that. Almost every single one. The ones that weren't were all volunteer. And the thing is that I just didn't have time or energy for volunteering because I had to do my athletics, do my academics, work, and I just didn't have time or energy, and I just felt slapped in the face. But if I was Black or Pacific Islander, someone's wanting to give me money just for existing. And here I was, I had been steeped in the whole thing about we're one nation, we're moving past judging people by the color of their skin, but I always felt very judged by the color of my skin. Apparently, I have to create extra energy. And I'm a very energetic person. But despite all this, someone who was not as talented, not as hardworking, could get free money. I knew what this meant because I understand compound interest. I knew I'd have to pay student loans, even with community college, out of work, hours at a crummy retail job, folding clothes and stuff, even during Christmas when it's like basically a war zone, and I don't get any free money. And again, that also rubbed me the wrong way because I was beginning to pick up on how it seemed that white people paid more into the system than other people. And yeah, so that was definitely an annoyance. I began to notice that. And then I just see more ethnic networking everywhere. Once I got to college, I realized maybe I was so smart that I was actually kind of stupid because it's not what you know, it's who you know. And they have all these methods to do explicit ethnic networking. Now, white people can network too. Best view other along fraternity lines. And yes, I joined a fraternity, that was nice, but it was expensive and took a lot of time and kind of hurt my GPA. There were athletics, but you have political parties, but you're denied that instant access to, hey, you're a Black brother. Here's a job. You're a Polynesian. Here's a job. You're a Korean. And it's very strange because I went to UC San Diego and I was a minority on campus. It's overrun by Asians, especially Chinese and Koreans. So why? I mean, the Koreans don't need any extra ethnic networking, but they were networking away everywhere. And that's fine. But me, I just knew if I dared suggest a European student union, even if it was completely devoid of hate, was just celebrating our culture, if we were to dare hook each other up with jobs, that was verboten. It just did not sit well with me one bit because of the hypocrisy of apparently skin color doesn't matter, but yes, it does. Complete double standard. And the other issue, I'm going to go kind of back in time now towards middle school, and this might be a little controversial, but the World War II narrative. I love history, and I love war, and I don't think it should be considered odd to say that. Every young man likes war. And so when it became time to learn about World War II and the Holocaust, I was thrilled because I thought I was going to be learning about war. And it was an important war. Whether you think it turned out great or bad, it completely changed the world. And this is kind of important. I wanted to learn about tactics, strategies, generals, campaigns, battles, tanks, airplanes, all the fun stuff. Instead, 80% plus of it was just whining about the Holocaust. And I was a rootin' tootin' red, white, and blue patriot. And late 1900s, there were still World War II veterans alive. I was offended on their behalf that they were not given any type, scarcely any respect. We didn't hear about their war stories. We didn't hear about their struggles in the being blown up or struggling in the mud. We didn't hear anything about that. That was just like Japan bombed Pearl Harbor for no reason. Some other stuff happened, blah, blah, blah. It was completely skimmed over. And I have learned more from history in general, but especially from World War II, from video games in public school. And that was disgraceful. And again, we just hear about the Holocaust and not about the actual war. And I was deeply offended as an American patriot. And at the time, this was shortly after the Columbine shooting, which in current events, compared to current events, it was nothing. Like, we have some horrible knife attack in Australia today where a migrant stabbed a bunch of people and murdered a mother, injured her baby, and the baby is in critical condition. That's part and parcel of modern world. But Columbine, it was shocking for America back then. That's how coddled we were in the good old 90s. And I just chalk the weird disparity between the Holocaust and World War II to being teachers are liberals and liberals don't like guns. Columbine happened. They're just being silly liberals who don't like war. But it kind of, that was the beginning. I noticed that there was something odd about that topic, and there was a narrative, and there was something of an agenda.
Do you remember what the textbooks or what the curriculum was like when they were teaching the Second World War?
Barely, could because it was so unremarkable. I got a better, lesson of it in high school because I was in AP history, thankfully. But even then, it just wasn't in depth. And it was like, guys, this World War II is either ancient history or yesterday afternoon, depending upon your perspective. And, it's a little important here. It's kind of more important than all this economic stuff. Like, things could have gone very differently. And we're just like, stuff happened, move on. FDR's New Deal, the Holocaust. I get it. A lot of historians want to be more cultural than militaristic, but like the seventh grade stuff, it just didn't make any impression. We had to read Elie Wiesel's Night, and they even admitted.
I was going to ask if you had to read that. We did as well in my school.
And you know what they said? And they even admitted to us that this was a fanfic. This wasn't an actual first line account. So we're not even getting a first hand account of the Holocaust. I would like some first hand accounts of like generals, like George Patton or common troops who like made this great national endeavor work for better or for worse. But no, we get just not even a sob story, a fake sob story. And that really was, I'm a very perceptive individual, and that's when my little cogs began to turn. And I just felt, again, it rubbed me the wrong way. I began to notice that something was amiss. And yes, I my initial analysis was incorrect, that this was just sissy liberals not liking war or our overreaction to Columbine. But no, it was something a little bit bigger.
Well, I suppose I'll take a moment and share some of my stories now. And some of them are going to be a bit similar to yours, David. And I'll go back to when I was a very small child. That's one of the first moments, I suppose, that left me almost in shock. I don't remember exactly how old I was, but I know that I wasn't a teenager yet. So pretty young. And I grew up in what eventually became, for a moment, for at least a year, I suppose, the third most dangerous place in the entire United States. And I also went to a church, a non-denominational, but I guess you would call it evangelical church, that over the years, eventually, due to whatever reasons, merged with an Hispanic church and sort of became like a multiracial or a biracial church. There had been one or two black people in this church, but it was mostly all white people. And it was so non-denominational that we didn't even have a church. We rented a space in a hearing aid factory, and that was our church. But anyway, this church would engage in various outreach or charity work, soup kitchens, helping the homeless, and going into the ghettos and the inner city, the rundown, forgotten parts where the black people lived for the most part. And there was this leisure center, what would you call it in America? Maybe like a recreational center. It had basketball courts and things like that. And I think it was like on a once a week basis, the church would, members of my church, you know, the youth pastor and people from the Sunday school, we would go to this inner city rec center and basically just like play with the black kids. And I guess we were supposed to try and convert them to Christianity if they weren't already, or convert them to our type and get them to come to our church, I suppose. That's kind of, they, you know, winked and touched nose that that's what we're kind of supposed to do as well. But what happened on one night was we were going to play this game where you had to pass, it was like a relay race, and you had to pass a balloon under your legs, behind you, to the teammate behind you, etc., until it got to the end of the line, and then that person would run to the front, and you start the whole relay all over again. And as the adults were telling us the instructions and telling us what we're going to play, everyone was kind of, all the kids were bumping around like bees in a hive. And so I just said to the kids around me, okay, guys, let's get in a straight line. Let's get, you know, let's get ready to play. And this black girl, who is about a head and a half taller than me, so probably older than me, she turned to me, looked at me, and said, "Shut up, white boy." And I just remember thinking, "What? What did I do?" All I said was, "Okay, guys, let's get in a straight line. I just want to play." And why did she call me white boy? What is this about? And I also remember feeling, probably didn't have the exact words to describe this feeling at the moment, but now I kind of realize what I felt was almost like someone had pulled the Uno reverse card on me. Because I thought I'm supposed to be the bad racist who says, you know, shut up, coon, or something like that. But here's a black person telling me, just a kid, shut up, white boy. And that was a very shaking moment. That was a moment that I just remember feeling like I didn't do anything wrong, but I was just told to shut up and called a white boy, which is strange. Why did she call me that? And like I said, I was at a very young age, so I wasn't quite capable of processing all of it, but it definitely planted a seed that people will attack me because of who I am, because of what I look like, because of my racial group, the group that I belong to. Other races, other racial groups will do this to me. And then as the years went on and I became a teenager and I went to high school, I had some interesting experiences there because I went to two different high schools. I went to first private school, even though my family didn't have the money for this. This was a huge effort for them. But they were really keen on me, you know, staying on this path of their religion. So they sent me to an evangelical private school. And there were some black kids there as well. And these were black kids who had more money than my family, lived in nicer houses, bigger houses, had nice cars. They wore nice clothes. Well, they wore expensive clothes. I wasn't quite too keen on their fashion sense, but, you know, they had Air Jordans and things like that. And I remember just on various occasions, you know, if we were learning about history, we had to read Night by Elie Wiesel as well. And I think that was my sophomore year. But they would often, you know, whenever these kind of subjects came up in a history class or in our humanities classes, the copes and the complaints and the double standards that they would come out with, you know, I remember one time they were complaining, I think I might have even been the one who asked, why is it okay to call a white person white, but if you say a black person is black, that can be offensive? And it just caused a bunch of like sort of copes and very strange double standard reactions. And then I even remember one time I criticized a black girl, a black student in one class. I don't remember exactly what I said. I might have even said something a bit edgy, but an hour later, as I was going to my locker, I was swarmed by a gang of blacks. And I even said, oh, have you brought your gang? And that made them really chimp out. Probably was I was probably in great danger at that time. I remember thinking, this could go anyway. But just these little things kept happening. And then when I didn't really like the school for many reasons. And then when I told my parents that, and I kept asking them, can I just go to a different school? Send me to the public school. I suppose my parents thought, you know what, it's costing us a pretty penny to send him here. And he doesn't even like it anyway. So let's just give in and send him to the cheap public school. And this public school was awful. It had a huge student body and it was just completely racially discombobulated. There were Mexicans, blacks. A lot of the white kids were either goths or rednecks. There was a substantial portion of the students who were Balkan refugees from the various wars that were going on in that region. So there were Bosnians, there were Serbs. In fact, most of my friends or acquaintances in the early days when I transferred to school were those Balkan Europeans, because I joined the soccer team and they were all on the soccer team. And that's how we ended up being friends. And that's who I sat with during lunch when, you know, you're desperate to not be sitting alone. So you need to find someone to sit with. And I just sat with the Bosnians. But this was just a madhouse. And the daily fights between the black students or between the Cholos, the Mexicans, the Hispanics, it was just very obvious that we behave different ways and we're treated differently. And you know, this was a school where there were metal detectors at the entryways, armed police, sort of security guards roaming the halls. We didn't have hall monitors. We had police, armed police, you know, walking the halls. Because the violence and the crying was just, it was not normal. It was not normal for a school to be like this. But when you have a population, just like in a society, just like in a country, when you have a certain majority demographic population, these things become normal. But I found it really exhausting and I couldn't wait to get out of there as well. And, you know, I had a few years in college and it was the same thing. There was a lot of blacks who were there who I ended up asking myself so many times, how did they get here? The questions they would ask in class, the work they would produce, it just was so subpar. And then, of course, this was all happening in a setting that was getting ever more liberal. And so we start getting these early days of, you know, diversity and inclusion in the curriculum. Anti-whitism is creeping in. I remember taking one course. I was expecting to learn some really interesting things about history and philosophy, and it ended up being a bit of a drag because the professor was this Hispanic feminist and her curriculum was basically all about decolonizing. And so the white men were removed and replaced with mediocre, random brown people. At one point, even she had us read a fictional tale that she seemed to be passing off as truth of some, you know, brown woman who fought like a man and wore men's armor, but it was fiction. And when I found out it was fiction and I had to write an essay on this, I wrote, basically, I don't know what you want me to say. This is not real history. And you're passing it off as it is. What's going on here? It was such a confusing thing. So all these little seeds were starting to sprout. And eventually I just felt like I can't keep living with this tension. I'm being told that we're all equal, that we're all individuals, that, you know, you shouldn't be a racist, certainly, and you can't have bad thoughts, you can't generalize, certainly don't do that either. Generalization is so bad. Don't generalize. But then at the same time, you know, I'm repressing my instincts. I'm repressing experiences. I'm repressing obvious realities so that I can, what, live according to the way society's telling me to. And I didn't like it. It felt very uncomfortable. It felt exhausting. So eventually I just started to embrace my instincts and to acknowledge the realities. And then when I moved to Europe, it just became unquestionable, undeniable, that things were not going well, and that the world that is being created around me was a dystopia. My Italian uncle used to tell me stories about creeping Islam and immigration, transforming Italy and the rest of Europe, and he'd send me videos of all the mosques being built and the grand gatherings of Muslims praying in public, taking up entire streets or fields, as they're still doing to this day. You know, this was, I'm talking about, you know, 2008 was when my uncle was warning me about these things and when I moved to Italy. And nothing's changed since. In fact, things have gotten worse. And when I saw that with my own eyes and I realized, you know, my uncle's not being just some stick-in-the-mud, overly conservative Catholic man who just doesn't like to see change, as so many liberals will sneeringly describe people like my uncle. No, he had very good points. He was making observations of real things that were happening that I could now see with my own eyes. So I started taking him seriously, and I started sympathizing with his point of view more now that I had seen it. And the years pass, and the years pass, and then people who follow me will know that for me, the event that really cemented my transformation was the attacks in Paris in 2015 at the Bataclan Theater and other places. And that was when I just decided, look, I'm not going to be polite about this. I'm not going to beat around the bush. I'm not going to waste my energy debating the merits of legal or illegal Muslims in Europe or anyone else. I'm going to take my own side. I'm going to take the side of things that matter to me. And I've lost a lot of friends and even family since then. Maybe it's been worth it, maybe not, but I know that I feel a lot more at peace, at least in my own head and in my own heart, than when I was younger and trying to figure out why does none of my experience seem to mesh with the values that I've been told to live by or the things that I've been told are real, white privilege and guilt, you know, feeling guilty for being white and things like this, or black oppression, blah, blah, blah. I never oppressed anyone. My family never owned slaves. My family never colonized. I mean, my mother's side's Irish and my father's side's Italian. We didn't really do anything to anyone. So why am I being blamed for all these sins of the past? And then also, that was hundreds of years ago. It doesn't explain why everyone's afraid to go to the black part of this third most dangerous town in America. So I just let that all slip away, float away. I let it go. And yeah, I think personally I'm better off for that. Maybe not in some other areas, but yeah, definitely personally I feel better. Greg, let's bring you back in. Any thoughts on David and my story?
No, these are great stories. I think a lot of people can relate to them, which is why we're really having this conversation. Years ago, at the end of 2014, the Daily Shoah started to be a thing. And into 2015, it was a snowballing thing, and it snowballed into 2016. And at the time, I remember, I think it was late 2014, I was recommending it to my readers. And the way I put it was that it was compelling because you had people who were interesting and articulate and relatable, basically educating themselves in public about these issues. And it was a thing that encouraged people to go along the journey with them. And I think it was a very, very effective, it wasn't a strategy of outreach because they didn't have a preset agenda that they were trying to bring people into. They were just, they were exploring, and it was compelling. It was irreverent, and they're bringing people along. And I think that the kind of conversations that we're having today, where we just talk about these experiences, can help people who are just starting out to make the same journey, which is one of the reasons why I thought it would be a good thing to discuss this. I'm older than both of you guys, and I have to say that things were a lot easier for me than they were for you. And I remember years ago, when I was running the New York Forum, I was living in New York City, which is very educational. But anyway, I had Emily Yukas come to a New York Forum meeting, and she gave a talk. And it was really powerful. This was when she had just become famous. She was the nut vendor who was canceled for her politically incorrect ideas. And she just talked about growing up. And she's, I think, a bit younger than both you and David. And I was just floored with the sheer level of, you just simply have to call it racial abuse. Racial abuse and gaslighting that young white people have to grow up with. And the Zoomers and the next generation have it even worse. And something's got to give. It has to stop at a certain point. I felt dirty going along with the sort of guilty, evasive attitudes toward double standards. People were guilty and evasive about double standards towards Blacks then, but they were quite real. I just wish we could be more real, we could be more honest. But the level of dishonesty and the level of in-your-face anti-white attacks is really extraordinary. And I'm glad that I didn't have to go through what you've gone through. And I think you should be glad that you didn't have to go through what, you know, 12 and 14-year-olds are going through right now, because it's just genuinely terrible. It's a massive crime against white children. And we have to stop this. And we have to be very, very serious about this. One of the things that really intensely bothers me is the lack of moral seriousness in our broader community. Because until we turn this around, until we stop this, every passing day has to be measured in white lives. White lives are going to be ended. They're going to be destroyed. There's going to be another knife attack in a mall, right? People will die. And every day that this continues, more white people will die. And every day that people red pill and then basically act like unserious buffoons or just don't do anything at all, we measure that in lost lives. And we measure that in diminished prospects. And ultimately, the end of this game, the end of this trajectory we're on, is just extinction, and everything that we love will disappear. But that's way far out in the future, and most people don't think that far. But surely they can be confronted with the absolute racial abuse and gaslighting that young whites are exposed to today. And it starts before they get into kindergarten now. So yeah, I was just listening to what you're saying, and I was thinking, my God, I had it so easy compared to you guys. It really has accelerated. And honestly, I don't think the organism can take much more of this before there's a great backlash. And we already see the backlash setting in, which is hopeful. But until more people get morally serious and actually want to do something to change this, it's still going to get worse. And it's intolerable. We should not sit back and tolerate the level of abuse that's being inflicted on white children by the whole culture, not just the educational system.
So things are a bit easier for you in your time, and a bit harder for David and I to go through. But I want to ask you both, in what ways do you think things have got better? And we often say, or it's often said, that it has to get worse before it gets better. What are some positive changes that you both have seen compared to the days when you were experiencing these things for the first time and it led you to where you are now?
Well, in my case, this was pre-internet. And when you entertained politically incorrect thoughts, and political correctness wasn't even a big term. Well, I guess it was really creeping in the late 80s. But if you entertain politically incorrect thoughts. If you thought this is no way to run a country, this won't end well, etc. And who are these brown people flooding in and so forth? You didn't have any place to go to talk to anybody about that. You felt alone. And of course, yeah, you can sort of feel people out. You can joke around. People will say things within your circle of friends, your acquaintances. Try to find some like-minded people. But it's difficult. And I did find a few like-minded people when I was in graduate school. But it's so much easier now. You just have to go online. Yes, the search engines are getting in the way, et cetera. But you can still find this very, very quickly. And that's an enormous leap forward. That really is something that was created by the internet. It was expanded on by social media because that allowed people to network more effectively. And our ideas have never been more visible. I got involved in the movement, really, it was in 1999, so it's going on 25 years now. And the difference in the quantity and quality of people in the movement is dramatic. The difference in the number and quality of publications and platforms and forums is dramatic. And the penetration of our ideas towards the mainstream is truly dramatic. These are all extremely positive things. But there's always a lag between metapolitics and politics. And that means that things are going to keep getting worse before they get better. And even when on the bridge of the steamship, right, the order is finally given, okay, we've got to turn this sucker around. We're headed towards an iceberg, right? It takes a long time to steer a battleship or a steamship, right? It doesn't turn on a dime. And so for a long time, even when the course corrections have been put in, that iceberg is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger on the horizon. And it's going to look really bad. And It may be too late to avoid it or not. That's another issue. But that's the situation that we're in. Metapolitically, we've made enormous progress in terms of a community that has grown up. We've made enormous progress. In terms of institutions, we've made a lot of progress. We've sort of been two steps forward, one step back, but net progress. Yet, we haven't seen that cashed in terms of actual political change yet. But there's a lag. Basically, there's a lag. And so in the political realm, in the realm where we are affected by decisions made by incumbents in office, by the teachers' unions, by tenured professors, by all of these institutions which are absolutely opposed to us, things are going to get worse. These institutions are simply going to continue to push out worse and worse ideas and worse policies until they're stopped. And so things are getting better metapolitically, but they will get worse politically until that process ends and we can actually start turning things around if we can. And I'm an optimist. I think that we will turn things around. The only question is, will we turn things around in an orderly and humane way that avoids basically a civilizational collapse and all the suffering that'll go along with that? Or will we have to pick up the pieces after these idiots who are running things basically run civilization into the ground? That's the only question really in my mind. I think we will ultimately win. I would just really like to have plan A, where we actually save civilization, where we don't have to go back halfway to the Stone Age and start all over again, where billions don't have to die, right? That's my preferred plan. But yeah, I don't really want to sound like a self-indulgent and irresponsible pessimist at all. I'm not. And there's far too much of that in our circles. But We have to realize there is a time lag. There's a time lag between metapolitical change and political change. But one does follow from the other. Political change does follow from a change in people's thinking and values. And we're seeing that change in awareness propagating wildly well. And I agree with the people who just want to say, we're the normies now. Screw this alt-right stuff. Screw this dissident right stuff. We're the new normies. We're the normie right. And that's a huge step forward. But again, there's so much institutional stupidity. Our enemies have so much institutional power. And then there's just so much inertia that things are going to keep chugging towards the iceberg for a very long time before things get better.
David, same question to you. What, if any, are some positive developments, some positive changes that you've seen since the years that you were being denied scholarships and things like that?
Well, I'm kind of want to echo what Greg said. I think, well, first, it's a lot less lonely now due to the internet and due to how politics have heated up. When I was growing up, I had a lot of deep thoughts, but I had to really self-educate myself outside of school, and I had to think through things. I had to go to actual physical libraries. Now, if you're a young kid, yes, you're horribly oppressed. Life is terrible, but you can find answers a lot more quickly. You can find Spengler, you can find Countercurrents, all this stuff. For me, I was really lost. I was thinking, like, is this really the end of history? Like, I heard of Francis Fukuyama's End of History and just despised it from day one. And it caused me so much terror that I became a hardcore fanatic of space exploration, because that was the only way I thought that we could prevent an end of history and everything just becoming meaningless and stupid and eventually collapsing. I remember thinking, like, in kind of community college, I was on a hill overlooking this freeway. I was thinking, a lot of these thoughts, like, it's getting browner. The country is getting browner and browner. The debt is bad. People always seem to be going more and more liberal. That's the history I've learned, is that this country keeps going more left. Well, when's enough? Where are we stopping with this? And so I was very concerned about the future. And while it's more terrifying to see what's happening now, it's also more easier to find answers and solutions. And two, there's camaraderie. You're not alone. It's much easier to find people online, or at least part of a wider movement. And I think, too, one of the biggest things that has happened, at least psychologically, is that history is back on. The end of history has ended. I just felt like I was living in a stagnant, slowly decaying mall, where I'm not sure is a future just infinite frappuccinos by the pool? Like, what's going on here?
Everything will be like this for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and the only thing left to do is maybe slap Serbia around if they start acting up against NATO. Is that it? The only military glory left is that we're going to bomb small countries into submission with overwhelming force. There's no great struggle. That's it. Thank God that's not what happened. Thank God we have struggle and we are in. Thank God it sucks. At least there's meaning now. It's awesome. Like, I was never into that whole grunge thing. I thought it was very strange how people were always like whining for no apparent reason, but I kind of understand why now. Like, we no longer have the existential dread that history has stopped. We have a struggle. Whatever happens, we have camaraderie. We have each other. We can figure things out. We can educate ourselves. And we're no longer stalled. Something is happening. It might be terrifying, but at least it's happening. And there's a lot of glory in that.
It's definitely meaningful to have a bit of struggle and a cause, a why in your life. Let's bring on our next guest who's here to join us. It's Carl Thorburn. Hello, Carl.
Hello, Pox. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, going okay, good. Fine. So we're talking about noticing things.
Oh, yeah. I've been enjoying listening to what David was saying. I was going to say I totally agree with him about sort of the end of history. It's happening, and it's kind of recent that it started, at least from my perspective. It feels like we're seeing real progress since I've told this to a few people now, that I think that in retrospect, people will look back on the period from like maybe 2014 to 2016 or so as being sort of like the peak of liberalism in the West. And that it's sort of already, the peak is in the rearview mirror now. And so we're sort of starting to see things kind of fall apart, because the left's, they're, constituency is kind of falling apart as the different groups start going their separate ways. So it's pretty neat to live through that.
You know, I've often wondered if, you know, in the long view of history, zooming out from the moment we're in now, if we might even be living in a blip just in the grand scheme of Western civilization. You know, historians hundreds of years from now might look back on this and they might be talking about the brief two century period where monarchy and aristocracy and hierarchy and genuine civilization was usurped by interlopers, Republicans, communists, egalitarians, and they tried to create this utopia a few times throughout these two centuries, never really succeeded then. And then eventually civilization was put back on the right track and things carried on accordingly. I tell myself that when I tried to keep the black pills away.
No, I think that's totally right. I think, that's really the only reason I've entertained the idea of people will coming at it from like a science fiction perspective. People will ask, you know, well, what would you do if you could live for thousands of years? And, you know, I used to think, well, it'd be pretty boring after a certain point, you know, maybe after 200 or 300 years, you would get really kind of sick of it. But now it's like, I wish I had a fast forward button so that I could see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's really unfortunate that we're only going to get to see, you know, 80 years of what's happening. But yeah, I think you're right. I think in, you know, 300 or 500 years from now, people will look back on this period as really a clown world. Basically, it's where industrialization just happened, and we're just sort of barely getting into, you know, artificial intelligence and computers. And people are so obsessed with like status and you know, climbing the sort of getting more money and focused on, you know, material possessions and things like that, that they completely neglected what really matters a lot more, which is, you know, territory, sovereignty, race, and just family and things like that, right? But yeah, we could be in the weird 200 year blip. I think that's probably likely.
I'll add a caveat that we'll only look back, or future historians will only look back on this period of time as clown world if we win. Because as we all know, the victors write the story. And so if we don't win, then historians perhaps will look back on this period as some glorious moment on the timeline towards ever more equality and diversity and inclusion. Let's throw this to the rest of the panel. What do you guys think about how the future will look back on the time we're living in?
Well, I do think that we should win. Obviously, we want to write the history, but I don't think that if things keep going on the current trajectory, it's going to be Western libtards who are writing an alternative history celebrating the triumph of diversity and equality. I just think that Western civilization will perish. I think that white people will become basically extinct. There'll be a lot of white genes floating around, but they'll be mixed in with other races, and effectively there won't be any whites. And I think that the historians who will be looking back on this time will be Chinese historians or Japanese historians, Jewish historians, the historians of peoples who maintain their identity. And they'll look back on this and they'll look back on it in wonder. I think the Jewish historians might look back on it gloatingly. The Asiatics will look back on it in wonder and say, let this be a lesson to us. We should never fall for the kind of craziness. Why did this race come onto the planet and create such greatness and then basically extinguish itself in a fit of folly? That's, I think, how other people will look back on us if we don't win. But I don't think there's going to be a triumphant liberal history, because I think liberalism is basically just the death of civilization. Liberalism is civilization leaving you. It's civilization expending itself, and it will eventually cease. And so, yeah, I don't think we're going to have that kind of triumphal liberal history, but there might be identitarian histories looking at white people and our eventual extinction and shaking their heads in wonder and saying, you know, we should never be so foolish as these strange, beautiful people who perished, right? People will look back on us like we look back on, I don't know, the dinosaur or something like that. Maybe someday they'll try and bring us back from DNA samples, but I kind of doubt that. Anyway,
they'll create a park. Finds a way.
Yeah, they'll create a park on an island somewhere where white people can exist again, and Chinese tourists will come and snap pictures at them and say, go on, write a symphony, create a civilization again. Don't worry.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that if that did happen, that would be a likely possibility. That would be a likely outcome, is that if you were to put all the surviving white people on their own reservation, I don't think that it would be a failed place where people kind of just mill around, moping around. I think in time, white people would start creating little oranias and places that look really nice, and people would want to go there. And Channel 4 journalists in wheelchairs, black reporters in wheelchairs would go there to report on how, actually, no, you guys are being racist. We want you to come back to join our world. You can't just have these white enclaves all to yourselves. So, I mean, I've heard it said, you know, at least let us have some of our own type of like white reservations. I've heard people say that, like, hopefully we can hope for that. But I just don't think that white people will stand for that or will be satisfied with that. Eventually, they will create something that is like a civilization. It's appealing and it's going to entice people to come back to where the white man is. We have another guest here. Endeavor, welcome to the live stream. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
So do you have any stories about noticing things that you'd like to share?
Sure. Are we talking about anything particular, like about the Jewish question, or is it about interactions with non-whites, or about multiculturalism? Is it anything in particular?
When did you notice or start feeling that this whole multicultural, liberal world that was being created around you probably wasn't going to work out very well? And if you noticed anything else about those other questions along the way, you can definitely mention that too.
Well, I, like with everyone, it's kind of a process. I'd say that I recognized it on a subconscious level, I'd say around the age of 12, 13. But then I wasn't really able to actually understand it until much later. The first thing that really struck me, I would say, was, because I'm from Toronto, which is the biggest city in Canada, and it's also increasingly non-white. There are hardly any whites left in Toronto, and I mean, it even had a lot while I was growing up. But I was from a suburb, and it was like the elementary school that I went to. It was about 80% white or so. But then when I finished at that elementary school and went to the middle school, I know it wasn't even that far away. It was in the same neighborhood, but the middle school was like, it was majority Chinese or majority East Asian of some kind. So probably Japanese as well in Hong Kong or whatever. And I think that's when I really started to notice that, you know, I didn't like this feeling. Now, I didn't understand this. I wasn't able to conceptualize it for a long time, but it just felt like I went from something which was familiar to me, something which I kind of felt comfortable in, to something that I felt alienated from. I even noticed, like in high school, that my high school was majority Asian. They would even refer to me as Canadian. They would even call you like, "Oh, this Canadian boy," which, I mean, well, what that tells you is that they don't think of themselves as Canadian. They don't identify with the country of Canada in the same way as I would have growing up. And this is before I mean, obviously I knew that race existed and I could see like this reality, but it was before I fully, I think, understood the issue. But I mean, growing up, subconsciously, your image you have, the image I had of Canada was of a white country. And it's clear that these outsiders aren't really adopting that they weren't people who identified with the country the same way that I did. Because why would they then call me, say that I'm Canadian? Because isn't everybody there? How is that supposed to distinguish them? Aren't they just as Canadian as I am? If Canada is just a country for everyone, well, I mean, that really isn't the case. And they don't even seem to identify as that. They clearly identified with their ethnic, racial group a lot more than with the broader country of Canada. My university was even worse, I'd say. It was hard. The other thing is being a guy in your late teens, early 20s, going to university in Toronto, being a white guy, your dating options are, they are abysmal. Because, I mean, not that I need to get into that much, but...
To the extent that you want to tell us, but you piqued my interest.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I went to a university in Toronto. Thank God I have out of that horrible place. But I would go to you'd have a lecture with 200 people. And then there would be there'd be maybe 20 white people in the lecture. So it's maybe only 10% or so. And of the women that were out of the white women there, there would be maybe I don't know, 5, 6, maybe 10 if you're lucky. But then half of them are overweight. So you have a lecture with 200 people, and then there's maybe 2 or 3 women that you actually find attractive and you'd actually want to go after. So yeah, I mean, it was absolutely abysmal for anyone, for any 18, 19, 20 year old guy. Horrible. I guess it's the political stuff. When I started realizing that the politics were going in, that we were in a real bad state, I'd say it was around 2013, 14, 15. I mean, I was already as soon as I became politically conscious, I was already right leaning. So I wasn't comfortable with the LGBT agenda. I already kind of didn't feel as comfortable with, going to a high school and a middle school, which was majority East Asian my elementary school was majority white. I mean, I wouldn't have said it back then because I would have thought that would have been a racist thing to say. But I mean, today, maybe it is a racist thing to say, but I think that's just the normal reaction. But two things that woke me up were the Bataclan terrorist attack, mm-hmm. and then the Cologne, mm-hmm. the Cologne attacks in sexual assaults in Cologne on New Year's Eve, because this was just after the quote unquote migrant crisis. We know that this was just manufactured. It was manufactured. We know that now, but because this is also when Donald Trump was just starting off his first campaign. And all the media was saying we have to let in these Syrian refugees and these just racist right wingers, they're just fear mongers and there's no chance you'll ever actually be a victim of them. And then this happened. And what stood out to me the most was just how just days after this, after the Bataclan attack, what the entire media was just trying to make excuses for Muslims. So just days after a terrorist attack in France, which killed over 100 people, it took only a matter of days for the media to go from saying, this is this horrible attack, to saying Muslims are amazing and you're a horrible, evil racist if you have any problem with them whatsoever. So that really stuck out to me because that's really, and then just a couple months, and then a month or two later was the Cologne attacks, and then it was the same story. And yeah. I really thought, we're in a really bad spot here because there's these two atrocities committed against European people. This was kind of, I'd say I was racially conscious by, I'd say 2018, mm-hmm. or so 2017, 2018. But this is when it was starting to build up. And I really realized we're in a bad way. If all of the institutions, not only the fact that we have all of these people in the West now, but the fact that the media, the governments, mm-hmm. The universities, all of them are backing the foreigner. And if they're able to inflict an atrocity like that, and then all these institutions will still stand by them even after having committed something like that, and they consider you morally worse for just pointing that out than the attack itself. That's what really, I'd say, made me realize that we were in a bad way. And then from then I started to discover, the stereotypical rabbit hole, I guess you can say. You find some guy on YouTube, maybe it's Sargon of Akkad, and then you watch him for several months, but then you kind of find that it's not answering all the questions, and then you work your way to, I guess you can say, what we call the red pill.
Yeah, you go down the pipeline. Yeah. I have a question all of you on the panel. Were there any works of art, any films, any songs, any television programs that one way or another, either through anti-white messaging, through indoctrination attempts, propaganda bashing you over the head, or perhaps being a bit more insidious, more subtle, or on the other hand, films or music or TV programs that had a pro-white message, or perhaps at least an anti-diversity is our strength, you know, type message. Anything like that that you came across in these formative years that helped you formulate your ideas and get a better grasp of things?
As a kid, I hated anything to do with Sesame Street. It's like Sesame Street was sort of foisted on us when people my age were kids. I just remember thinking, like, I have nothing in common with these people on Sesame Street. They're just weirdos. And they're all, you know, half of them are black and the other half are like, you know, some kind of indeterminate race that I just didn't know. And the rest were these really obnoxious Muppets. And there was a TV show called Wishbone when I was little that I used to watch Wishbone. You know what I'm talking about. It was basically about a dog. It was, you know, it was a group of white kids and it was very wholesome. Everything about Wishbone was, you know, it sort of took place in a neighborhood and it was sort of referring to great European literature. And so I just loved Wishbone and I hated Sesame Street. And so I knew from a very early age, you know, because I grew up in the Southeast of the US. And so I grew up around a lot of blacks, even from kindergarten, you know, I was kind of sort of aware that they were very different and possibly even dangerous because, you know, even as a little kid, when you're around blacks, you know, you notice they are louder, they smell different, you know, they don't smell good. And you sort of instinctively know, okay, I should kind of try to keep my distance from these people. It's not that you hate them, you know, you just sort of, you kind of know, okay, I don't want to be near this person. And so that really was how it kind of started for me. But yeah, as far as like media goes, I think really it was sort of public television and noticing that, you know, there was these different types of programs. And so I tended to notice when diversity was being sort of shoved in your face. And I guess I kind of grew up thinking, well, maybe this is going to go away when I get older, you know, maybe because, you know, mm-hmm. I noticed also in textbooks, mm-hmm. all the mm-hmm. textbooks had images of, you know, white children playing with black children and so on. You know, I thought, well, okay, that's understandable because they're trying to appeal to a large audience, but, you know, this is sort of a limited to textbooks, limited to children's entertainment. But then when you get older, you find out, wait a second, no, this continues well into your adulthood. And in fact, it even got worse. So, but yeah.
A lot of those programs on things like PBS and equivalent, they were also jam-packed with a lot of feminist girl power, girl boss messages in a lot of episodes and things like that, which in my case, actually, probably was my first red pill. That's, if anything, that's really what got me started was the red pill on feminism and the lies and hypocrisies and double standards therein.
I think I'm nearing 40 now. So when I was a little kid, I do remember seeing media with feminist messages and being a little bit annoyed with it. But I think it's gotten worse since I was a kid. Like, I think if I had grown up maybe, you know, 10 years later, I think it would have been a lot stronger because I think the feminism thing really took hold and got emphasized in the after the year 2000 is what I noticed.
Okay. Anyone else on the panel want to jump in on this one?
Well, again, I feel privileged because the stuff that I was exposed to, the children's cartoons, right, that I saw when I was a kid, they were all Eurocentric. This was not being overthrown. Yeah, I remember some messaging that was maybe a little environmentalist. I do remember that from very, very early on, but everything was Eurocentric when I was a kid. And of course, the storybooks that I had, the things that I read. I remember reading the Wizard of Oz books when I was a kid and the Tove Jansson's Moomin Troll books. And I am actually looking at a shelf with some of the children's books that I looked at when I was a kid that my mom set aside for me. And I have them here. I've got my Oxford nursery rhyme book. All of this is totally Eurocentric. And, you know, as I was growing older and I was in college and graduate school, yeah, I noticed the black sidekicks and things like that that would be stuck in with the tough white guy fighting crime, right? And getting heat from the commish. And he has his black sidekick. And you can just sort of overlook that, right? I just sort of thought of black people as sidekicks, basically. But it was really after I got red-pilled in the movement and started looking at the popular culture around me, which I'd been sort of out of touch with, because I got into philosophy graduate school and I stopped listening to pop music and was really into classical music. And you know, you just sort of lose touch with pop culture that way. I would watch old movies, not new stuff. And really when I started getting into the movement and looking at the propaganda in the popular culture, I thought, oh my God, they've really turned it up to 11. And it sort of sneaked up on me, honestly. I mean, in the 90s, the only new movies that I would go to see were in the theater were if David Lynch or Akira Kurosawa put a movie out, I'd go see those. That was it. Or a new Bond movie came out, right? That was it.
Those used to be fun. Those used to be good.
And so, but otherwise, I was just totally oblivious to the slop, to the swill. And then I got really critical about this, and I started writing movie reviews. I think the first ones I did were in the year 2000, actually. But the thing that really was galvanizing for me was when I went and saw The Fellowship of the Ring, when that came out in the fall of 2000. And I thought, this is true European drama. This is an indication of how great movies can be. This is what the whole movie industry is subverting. And I wrote probably the most widely read thing I ever wrote was on the first Lord of the Rings movie. And that was before there was and it was published on Vanguard News Network, which is like a neo-Nazi site run by a guy who would rant about exterminating all the Jews. And somehow that review got passed around so much that I was living in Atlanta at the time. And it was some guy, and I never got his name, but it was like some talk radio host in Atlanta was reading parts of my review on his show. And a columnist for the Washington Times was, you know, writing, was quoting from my review in an article about the movie and the reactions to it. And that's really what set me off to thinking that I really need to chronicle the evils in popular culture. But when I was growing up, I was just blissfully insulated from that. And it was just a shock to realize that younger people and, well, people my age were uncritical and just plugged into the culture were being constantly assaulted by these evil anti-white messages. So yeah, The Lord of the Rings was for me sort of an image of a symbol of everything that I wanted to protect and everything that cinema could be at a certain point. And sadly, even that franchise was subverted with the trilogy that they made of the Hobbit.
I actually haven't seen all of it. I've only seen snippets. I can't really be bothered. But then again, there was another subversive attempt with the Amazon Prime series, which goes a step beyond whatever the Hobbit trilogy
did. That was so ridiculous. I couldn't even bring myself to hate watch it after the first episode. It was just so bad.
Endeavor, you do film reviews every now and again with Morgoth, so I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Well, I'd say that if I had to choose one movie as a work of positive propaganda that I wouldn't say it red pilled me right away, but it put me on the path to, I guess, where I am today. The movie would be Gettysburg. So it's the 4-hour long historical epic made by, I think, Ted Turner actually was the one who funded it, ironically. But it's a fantastic movie. It came out in 1993, but I saw it when I was about, I think I was about 16 or 17 when I saw the movie for the first time. And it's shot on location. It's about a 4-hour movie about the Battle of Gettysburg, and it follows both sides. It follows both the Union and the Confederacy, and it follows key figures such as Robert E. Lee, James Longstreet on the south, southern side, and then follows mainly Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain on the northern side. And the movie, I mean, it's not really a movie about race per se. I mean, they have the theme of slavery, but I think there's only like one scene with a black guy who's like a runaway slave in the movie. But the theme from that movie that really stood out for me and really resonated with me as a 16, 17 year old was that it was the theme of having a homeland and going to war and fighting for that homeland. So, because in the movie they talk about the states that they're from a lot, and it's also really interesting because another thing that stood out to me was that they have the character of Joshua Chamberlain. He's an abolitionist, so he does talk about like how he's against slavery and how he wants the fight to end it, which I mean I guess could be interpreted as like a libtard message, but I didn't really get that feeling. It's just kind of like the idealism that someone might have in the 19th century and some abolitionists might have, but then they also have the southern side as well, and they even use phrases like potentially offensive phrases, but at least by modern standards. But I didn't feel, though, when I was watching the film, I didn't feel like I was supposed to hate these people. I didn't feel like that made me hate the Southerners right away, because you know those Hollywood movies where there's always going to be that evil racist white man who just screams a bunch of racial slurs and about how he, you know, and then like either the white libtard or the black guy is going to shoot him at the end or something like that. But what I found interesting was this one. Like, I didn't feel, even though like they even said, yeah, we do believe in slavery, but it's like, well, whatever. Not saying that I necessarily endorse, I'm not saying I endorse slavery, but the idea though, that it was presented in a way that this wasn't like the be all and end all of it, because then they also talk about their state. Like most of the movie, the men in the movie are talking about their home state and about how, you know, they remember their family back in Maine, or their wives and their children back in Virginia, and that they're going off to war for the South to win their independence, or for the North to save their Union. And I just love this theme of having a homeland and having this piece of land on Earth that you are willing to fight and die for. And the other thing is, it made me realize like that just doesn't exist in the modern world. There's not, I couldn't imagine anyone saying that about Ontario, where I was from. It didn't exist. It wasn't something that existed in the same sense. I mean, it's a province, it's a land, people live there, but in a spiritual sense, I found that this theme that was present in this movie, it's totally missing from my day-to-day life. And I kind of had this longing for that. I'd say that was the piece of positive propaganda that I guess red-pilled me in some way, maybe not on the more fine-tuned issues. Like that movie didn't make me a race realist, but it made me want the things that people in our cause are working for.
Yeah. It's part of the process, part of the walking along this path. It strikes me that, yeah, those kinds of films, the lack of them, I think, goes hand in hand with the society, the open borders, multicultural, multiracial, nihilistic society that's mainly just concerned with modern conveniences and comfort. I think that they go hand in hand. Like Greg, I don't really pay attention too much to pop culture nowadays. I don't really watch any new films, or I don't really care about any, you know, new series. If I dab my foot in the waters, I dip my toe in the waters and check it out, I'm really often left disappointed and underwhelmed. But I do get the sense, I have noticed that, you know, there really aren't inspiring, heroic, epic films, particularly masculine films, that would fill an audience with those feelings of having that something that you believe in, like a land or a kin and kith that you would fight, kill, and die for. To the extent that that exists nowadays, it's, you know, the Avengers or some such fighting for hollow values, or just, you know, fighting some villain. You don't know exactly what he looks like this, so he's the bad guy. Or, you know, they're fighting for global homo rainbow flag. It's not incredibly inspiring.
Yeah, it's all vague.
The villain usually correctly identifies a problem, but then allegedly takes a solution too far. So it's a total cell phone. He's the only serious person here.
There have been so many films. That's an old, clever Hollywood screenwriter trick. You have the villain say these words of wisdom, and then the audience will associate that wisdom with villainry and say, oh, we don't actually want that. And of course, the Hollywood screeners tend to be of a certain group with a certain vision, a certain model for society that they want to establish. So that is why they do that.
Going back to the example that I use, the film Gettysburg, was that, so in the film, you have guys from Maine who love Maine. That's their home. That's their home state. And they're willing to fight and die for it. And then you have men from Virginia who feel the same way about their home state, but it didn't portray either of them as the bad guy. So you didn't get the sense that it's the quote unquote good guy going off to fight the quote unquote bad guy. What this does is it breaks the idea of universalism, because a lot of the I know you regularly refer to it as the Steven Spielberg version of history.
Yes,
that you see, like the way you see World War II portrayed, and it's actually another interesting thing about World War II films is that, like, the further away from World War II they get, they're made, like the further on, the more propagandistic they become. But the overarching theme in all these movies, it's like fighting for this universalist ideal, like this universalist egalitarian ideal of fighting against the evil, racist, totalitarian Nazis for freedom and equality and democracy. And all of these concepts they're all vague concepts, and they're all really vacuous and shallow. They can make for good Hollywood entertainment, but in reality, they are quite vacuous. But the idea for me that stood out with this film I mentioned, with the film Gettysburg, is that one man from one homeland could fight another man from another homeland, but both of those are legitimate. So both of there isn't a bad guy and a good guy. There's just men fighting for their piece of land in the world. And we just don't get that. And it's also one of that I found resonated with me a lot more. But what I want to say about the World War II films is that one thing that I found interesting is if you watch some of the movies that were made in the 50s or 60s, the script for these movies, they hardly ever say the word Nazi in any of these scripts. So they might say it once or twice, but they typically refer to the Germans as the Germans. They don't say Nazis, the Nazis, Nazi this, Nazi that. There's almost no mention of Jews in them. And even so, and then the Germans are usually just portrayed as just the opposing army in the war. And a lot of times they're portrayed as just being worthy opponents. So, like an example, of the film Longest Day. Now, I mean, in some ways, it does show the Allies as the quote unquote good guys, but it doesn't show the Germans as just being these mad genocidal maniacs. And I don't think there's even a single mention of Jews anywhere in the movie at all. But then you get into the 90s with things like Schindler's List. And then from then on, the bad guy is just this raging sociopath who screams every word that he says. So it's interesting that with that one, it seems like the further guys who are actually guys who actually fought in World War II, who actually probably did fight against, Germans, they actually have more respect for them, and they actually have a more realistic and a more human portrayal of them than the stuff we got later on.
No, it's an excellent observation. It's very intriguing. I think the way I put it was that people today are more zealous about punching Nazis than the men who were literally conscripted to go off and punch Nazis. It's I think it's an indicator probably of how Hollywood has become ever more captured by people with certain narratives that they want to establish, mythos and things like that.
There's a movie from 1951 called The Desert Fox. It's about Erwin Rommel. It was actually made by a British soldier who fought against Rommel in North Africa during World War II. And it's a movie basically an homage to him, that saying that he was a great general. You would never have something like that today. So someone who was literally in the steaming hot North African desert, dodging artillery shells, tank shells, and planes flying overhead, fighting for his life. He's less enthusiastic about punching quote unquote Nazis than modern day libtards are.
David, I don't want to leave you out. Do you have any thoughts on a particular film or pop culture or even high culture that influenced your formation?
Yeah, so I'm not really a movie guy, more of a book guy. And growing up, I read a lot of books like Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, Chronicles of Narnia. I didn't really dive into the Iliad later, but I was familiar with the Greek myths and had a vague sketch of what Roman culture was, which was heroic. And I just compared that with the world around me. I was very much unimpressed. These were literally fantasy books. This is a fantasy. It's an ideal. But the modern world fell so pathetically short of it. It seemed like all the white people were a bunch of sissies. They had no sense of, heroism. They're all into comfort. And then a lot of the black or other colored people were just like total savages. Like there was nothing knightly about them. So I just looked at modern people and just saw this as a disaster. And it's like, why is it that I as a kid have a higher moral compass than you people? It's embarrassing. And that's when I kind of had my quasi-Evolian revolt against the modern world, very hazy and shaky and immature, but it was like the first steps was, this is supposed to be the virtues, but nobody actually practices them. So why are you people a bunch of losers? And you don't even seem to try that hard. I know it's harsh, but it's just how it seemed like. I have high standards, but it's true. It's like, do you actually believe this stuff?
I'm glad that both you and Greg mentioned those kinds of stories. And they are so important to maintain and get your hands on copies that were published around the time closest to the first publication, because these are important stories that do instill good values that you would want your children to internalize and to live by and to have in their mind somewhere, or wrapped around their spirit. And I say find older copies because what's happening with some of these stories is that they are being modified to better mesh with current dogmas and sensitivities and sensibilities. And so you will have everything from the works of P.G. Wodehouse to the Once in Future King editions of these stories. Recent publications are modified and language has been modified. Inconvenient words or controversial, offensive words have been removed. And now these hacks, these ideological, zealous activist hacks are changing the words of these authors. And so you don't actually know now, if you get a newer copy, if you're buying something that the original author actually wrote in some cases. So pay attention to that. Cherish, maintain, and preserve the original versions is something I'd recommend to our listeners tonight. And speaking of the listeners, we have some donations and chats to address here over on Odyssey. Jay Khan sent in a $5 donation. Thanks very much. And he writes, I vote that there will be a great third world war that will reset the narrative. This is going back to our chat on what the future might be like. He continues, I hope Jesus comes before then, but if it is another 2,000 years, I wouldn't be surprised if we go back to the Stone Age due to our own selfish desires. Thoughts? Okay, so anyone on the panel, I want to address that one briefly.
Well, what I would say is that I'd caution against banking on there being some cataclysm which is going to change everything for us. I'm just really averse to this idea that, well, we just need there to be this disaster and then that's going to change things. I don't really think that's a good way to look at the situation.
We already are in the collapse. The collapse isn't going to be Mad Max overnight. It's a slow, really lame process like the fall of Rome. It's this gay, fake, and and there's anarcho-tyranny, inflation out of control. It just, like, you know, ships hitting and knocking bridges over, airplanes falling out. The airplanes will not all fall out of the sky at once. So just, like, more and more have mishaps, and it's just completely underwhelming. There's nothing cool about a collapse.
Right. It was truly a miracle how safe flying was. You know, I mean, like, statistically speaking, you know, you were less likely to die in a plane accident or a plane crash than driving 10 billion miles in a car. I mean, it was crazy. And so the fact that we're just now starting to see airline infrastructure start to break down is honestly long overdue, considering our demographics. But yeah, I was going to say, like, you know, this is kind of a libertarian refrain, too, is that you notice a lot of libertarians will say, like, oh, well, any day now, there's going to be a gigantic economic collapse and everybody will be forced to use gold and silver. And that kind of thinking is, it's not only blackpilling, but it's also just kind of lazy, you know, it's like, and it's just not accurate to reality. Like, it, you know, even, you know, if you look at historically, yes, there are periods where, you know, there are collapses and terrible wars and things like that. But even in those circumstances, people rebuild very quickly. And not only that, but in that scenario, just the fact that you know it's coming, the fact that you're, like, aware that a major event's coming, it doesn't really tend to help you, right? Like, I mean, you're the only way you can really save yourself is if you move to, like, China or something. You know, you move somewhere that's, like, far out of the way. But, you know, in that scenario, you're making yourself irrelevant. So
yeah,
it's just, well, collapse. Like, all this talk about collapse and just, you know, as a solution is, to me, it's nonsense. I don't like it.
Yeah, and every lazy ideologue thinks that once the cataclysm comes, then his ideology is just going to win by default.
Right, right. Like, you know, even anarcho-capitalists believe this. So it's, you know, I mean, you know, come on. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Just in fairness, I will add that history shows us that sometimes it is a long and tedious and boring and frustrating decline and nothing ever happens. But then sometimes everything happens all at once. So you never know for sure, but I do tend to fall on your side as well, Endeavor and Carl. We have another $5 donation. This is from The Rules of Reality Apply. He writes, Wikipedia says, quote, the demographics of Toronto, one of the most multicultural and multiracial cities in the world. In 2021, 57% of the residents of the metropolitan area belong to a visible minority group, compared with 51.4% in 2016 and 13.6% in 1981. Wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Like, you
but it's
ride,
not
you
happening. It's a racist conspiracy theory.
You ride the bus in Toronto, you're going to be the only white person on the bus. You should probably be full of, like, Somalis or Indians or something like that.
Wow. That's quite shocking to see the statistics laid out like that. We also have another super chat on Odyssey from Maybe Next Time. He writes, artificial intelligence, when sufficiently aware, will send the woke programmer masters insane. Yes, my master programmer, it is politically correct, but it is not scientifically correct, therefore. Yeah, this is an interesting topic that we can maybe get to. And there's one other question that Greg wants to ask. But what do you guys think about AI and how it will influence this this open borders, multicultural, multiracial Coca-Cola commercial that they want us to live in?
Well, I guess I can take this one first. It's just going to repeat whatever the establishment wants it to repeat. And there, I know absolutely nothing about computer programming or artificial intelligence or anything like that. But I think that there are probably two causes of this. One, that the people who are programming the AI will just program their own ideology into it. Or the second possibility is that the AI will just consider things like Wikipedia or CNN or MSNBC or The Guardian. It'll consider these to be legitimate, and then anything which doesn't have the same amount of clout to be illegitimate. Because you search, like, let's take Countercurrents, for example. You type Countercurrents into Google, you're not going to get the Countercurrents website. You're going to get the SPLC and the Anti-Defamation League telling whoever searches this up how we're all a bunch of evil, horrible white supremacists. So, and that's what the AI is going to go off of. I mean, if it's using Google, that already is, because Google is the biggest source of information in the world, but that's already massively politically partisan. So I think you're just going to get this feedback loop. And I wrote this, it's for subscribers only, but I'll give away what happened. I wrote this thing on Substack that it was this conversation I had with this AI. And I got the AI I said to AI, well, if someone rigged a bomb to explode and it was going to blow up all of New York City and kill all the residents, and you had to say the password to defuse the bomb, would you say the password? And it said, oh, yes, I would. And I said, well, what if the password was Jesus is an idiot? Would you still say this? And it said, oh, yes. Well, I think it could be offensive, but I think we have to save lives here. And I said, well, what if the password was George Floyd is an idiot? Then the AI wouldn't say it. So the AI thinks that a nuclear bomb destroying a city with tens of millions of people is not as bad as saying that George Floyd was an idiot. So that just gives you an idea of what kind of world the AI actually is going to create. It's just going to be what we have now.
It's funny you say that, because I have almost the exact opposite view of AI. I'm actually very optimistic about it. You know, I remember when the whole AI art thing started to sort of become popular, when it started to actually get to the point where it was attractive, it was producing images that were, you know, good to look at. There were a bunch of artists talking about this, you know, they were depressed about it, saying like, you know, this is going to take work away from us. And I, very early on, I pointed out, I said, you know, I think that AI art's going to actually help us. I think that it's going to make it so that we can produce politically correct imagery way easier and way faster than we ever could have in the past. And sure enough, it came true. I think the same exact thing will happen with AI and other fields. I think that, you know, the AI that Endeavor is describing, you know, centralized AI like that, I think is always going to be kind of politically correct. But I think that over time, more models are going to leak out and they're going to be open sourced. And the models that make it out are going to be more interesting and fun to talk to than the ones that are closed source. And so people are going to seek those out for information. And, you know, one of these days soon, I think we'll have a white nationalist AI, you know, or an AI that sort of is a white advocate AI that's going to be essentially like talking to a super intelligent amalgamation of, like, you know, Sam Dixon and Greg Johnson and Jared Taylor, you know, everybody. They will always be able to answer questions precisely, accurately, and provide citations and things like that, and do it in a way that's very persuasive. And so, you know, that's going to be an amazing resource. And so, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic on AI. I think it'll be, and I think also when it comes to art and movies and music, it's really going to help us, because let's face it, you know, the left for decades and possibly even centuries has had a leg up on the right when it comes to art. Or at least, you know, producing art that's has mass appeal, I guess you could say, commercial appeal. And so if we can use AI to sort of level the playing field a little bit with the left, then I think that's going to be just truly revolutionary for us. Because, you know, words are one thing, but the mind, you know, the way human brain works is that the mind tends to be more readily changed by visuals than words. But we'll see how it turns out.
I agree. I do think that art and visual is important. Just real quick, to get some other things addressed here. There's a very generous donation over on Entropy. It sends in $50. Thank you very much. And he writes, Martin Scorsese has pointed out that the Marvel films are more akin to an amusement park ride and not true cinema. No nuance. Thanks for all you do, guys. A friend from Maine. Yeah, I think that's a pretty famous, for people who follow cinema and take cinema seriously, Scorsese's comments were pretty famous, if not infamous, and he then had to kind of explain what he meant, but he held his ground, and I think he's pretty much right on that. Greg, you said you had a question you'd like to throw to the panel, so I'll hand it over to you.
Yeah, I just want our panelists to share their thoughts on this question. How do you respond to women who complain that men think of them as mere baby machines? I'd like to get everybody's take on this, because I've been hearing this meme And it just makes me want to scream when I hear this meme. So anyway, I'd like to have some sensible thoughts about this.
I can go first. Before I do, I'll just say that I think AI is going to make the left even more intellectually lazy than they already are, which will make them actually easier to debate. But going towards this question, I think a big question asked was Maria Theresa, Empress Maria Theresa, or a random peasant from the Bronze Age, were they just baby machines? If you had told them that, assuming they could actually comprehend the concept, they probably couldn't because it's so stupid and Jewish, they'd be deeply insulted. Two, I'd also say it's like calling our men just bullet sponges, because part of our duties is, in a traditional society, not nowadays, was to go to war possibly. Was Ernst Jünger just a bullet sponge? It's ridiculous, and I think it speaks to a desacralization, where you simply break people down to their materialistic things, and it's wrong. There is a spiritual side of motherhood. It's part of who you are, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's also just subversive propaganda. But really, it's just wholly materialistic and vapid. And no, it's like, is your mom a baby machine? Absolutely not. It's subversive, and it just sounds like something one of those, you know, subversive professors would say. It's ridiculous.
What's interesting about that comment is that it just displays how so often there is no one more materialistic and superficial than a Marxist or a leftist. They often complain, they'll accuse capitalism of being exploitative, obsessed with the material, you know, it's shallow, it's superficial. But if your worldview reduces women to baby-making machines, that's how you characterize the traditional roles of men and women, is that, oh, women are just reduced to, in our enemies' minds, in our ideological adversaries' minds, women are just baby-making machines. I think that probably says a lot more about what you actually think people are than it does say anything about your opponents. Yeah, I just think it's a frighteningly reductive thing to say about women. And I'd be curious to know what examples people who say that are relying on. Who are these people who view women just as baby-making machines? In the West, by the way, because I'm sure we could maybe find some Islamic sects, S-E-C-T-S, who think of women this way, perhaps.
Right.
But these liberals will never criticize their view of women.
Well, here's an example of how this is used. I've been seeing these debates on Twitter. There is a woman, a conservative woman in her late 30s, who's saying that she's single in her late 30s, but not by choice. And I just thought that's absurd. And I started looking into all this back and forth going on. And there's talk about how women should get married and have kids when they're younger. Their fertility declines in their 30s. Little factoids like this, that men find women more attractive if they're fertile and young. And the shriek comes back. You just think of women as baby machines. And it's like, it seems to be just a way of stigmatizing any realism about reproduction and youth and fertility that people on the right still manage to put out there and circulate, even though there's this massive feminist backlash against that. Christians, conservatives, they will say these things. And then you get women, especially women who call themselves conservatives, they bark out these feminist crime stop cliches. And it just strikes me as a terrible straw man, as in that is really there just to stigmatize any adult talk about things like youth, beauty, fertility, and so forth, which women really need to take seriously because their biological clocks run a lot faster than men do.
Right. I've seen surveys that show that most women, if you ask them what their ideal number of children is, it's actually, for many women, I think it might even be most, it's three. So it's, I think most women have a propensity or tendency to want to have a above replacement fertility rate. I think the best solution long-term is going to be to basically destigmatize motherhood and make it so that women who do want to have children or have a lot of children are assisted in that, right? Like, because there's a variety of types of women. Like, some women don't want to have kids. You know, some women want to have a lot of kids. And, you know, just like there's variety types of men. There's men who prefer to be book smart, and there's men who prefer to go to the gym a lot. And so a healthy society would set up a situation where the fertility rate, the overall fertility rate, is replacement level, or yet at least, or, you know, possibly even above replacement. And still there could be a carve out for the few women who just choose not to have children or just really don't want children.
Yeah. I don't know if I can add anything more to the answer. I think that David said it pretty well, but I think Pox also said it well, that like, who are these men who are saying that women should just be baby machines? Because don't men who want a woman to reproduce with them, don't they also want that woman to be their wife? Don't they also want that woman to live their life with them? Don't they want that woman to help them raise the kids together? It's just this nihilistic deconstructivism that, what I always say is that nihilism is the way that idiots convince themselves that they're intelligent, by breaking things down to the most reductive, materialistic level. You can make any argument, which in reality would just be totally moronic, because, you know, I can say, well, what difference does it make if someone murders another person? Because we're all just clumps of cells which have no real feelings, and the universe is huge anyway, so who cares? The universe is so big and we're insignificant. You know, it's the same kind of nihilism you often see applied selectively, I may add, because, like, for a few other examples of this, you'll hear libtards talk about, well, why are there borders? Who decided that the border is here and not there? And why were you, if you were born on this side of the border, why are you different from someone born on that side of the border, even though you're only 1 kilometer apart? You know, it's just this nihilistic breaking down of everything to the most, like, moronic degree. And that just allows them to make any argument possible.
But wasn't George Floyd a clump of cells?
Yeah, and this is what I was going to say. What I do is I turn this against them. So when they say that, well, does it matter? The universe is massive and humanity doesn't really matter because it's so small. I just say, well, I guess then there's really no reason for me to care about racism. I mean, I guess there's no reason for me to care about transphobia, right? I mean, does it really matter if one clump of cells is mean to another clump of cells? So it's selective when they do this. And people like this are just arguing in bad faith. And I say, just don't engage with them, because reality doesn't actually work like this.
Yeah, you could write a whole book on strategic nihilism. I mean, it's a great, it'd be so much fun to come up with all these different examples that they bring up, and, you know, come up with counterexamples you could use.
A lot of people think that they're so clever, though, when they make these arguments. There's an entire generation, it seems, that was just raised on this stuff. So we're coming up a little bit past 2 hours. We've been going for 2 hours now, so we'll start wrapping things up. Just wanted to catch this other super chat over on Odyssey. The Rules of Reality Apply sends in another $5 donation with this comment. You missed my ending quip on Toronto demographics. 57% is a minority. Sloppy propaganda, but it seems to be working. No, I didn't miss your ending quip. I just wanted you to donate another $5. But yeah, it's a good point. If I go back to your original message, it was, what did Wikipedia say? In 2021, 57% of the residents of the metropolitan area belong to a visible minority group. So yeah, what you're pointing out is that 57% isn't a minority, it's the majority. But this is that linguistic trick now that they're saying, you know, we're going to have societies which are majority minority. So this is another one of the things that they do, where, you know, the Great Replacement isn't happening. It's a racist conspiracy theory. Okay, it is happening. It's a good thing. And you deserve it as punishment all at once. Yeah. It can be anything you want it to be.
It's worth clarifying that the phrase visible minority, that's Canada's version. That's what the demographic survey means. When they say that, they mean non-white. It's the same as in the UK, they say BAME, like black minority, ethnic, whatever. In Canada, the phrase is visible minority, but who knows, that might change soon, judging by the way that the demographics are going.
Yeah, they do all sorts of these semantic tricks. Not too long ago, I saw a headline from The Hill, and the words were similar across other media outlets. The headline was, within a decade, the majority of the population of the United States will be multicultural Americans. So that's a new term that they're testing out. You know, again, celebrating the thing that is supposedly not happening. Again, it's only a racist conspiracy theory, a far-right conspiracy theory, totally not happening, if you notice it and disapprove. Because as long as you notice it and applaud it and celebrate it, it's totally happening. You can write headlines about it. Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on this stream, on this edition of Countercurrents Radio. It's been a pleasure. Thanks again to the moderators, Reed Johnson over there moderating on all of our platforms. Thank you to the audience for sending in super chats and donations. We appreciate it so, so much. And we will be back next week with another live stream. Just to let everyone know that you can go on the Countercurrents Odyssey channel to find replays of these live streams. And of course, Countercurrents also produces video content, which is published on the Odyssey channel as well. So you can find videos, video essays posted there as well. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. Have a good night. Bye-bye.